Hello, 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 and welcome back to Behind the Walls of the World Psychiatric Hospitals. I'm your host, Dr. Sarah Gallup, and today we're going to start a new series on a hospital in New York near the Finger Lakes. I first learned about this hospital about 2 years ago or so when I read the book The Lives They Left Behind by Darby Penny and Peter Stastny, and I was immediately fascinated. So as we saw with Oregon State Hospital and Trenton Psychiatric Hospital, this asylum started out with good intentions, but it became the final resting place for almost half of the 54,000 patients who lived there over the course of 126 years. Today, we'll discuss what led to the development of the hospital and to the quick rise of the patient population. Now, I'll warn you that we won't be able to make it through all the history in this episode. So instead, we'll be covering about the first 40 years or so. So come on in and get comfortable as we go behind the walls of Willard State Hospital. If you recall in our very first episode about Oregon State Hospital, we discussed the concept of moral therapy. This was a form of treatment developed by English Quakers around the turn of the 19th century that focused on treating patients with dignity and respect, and offering them plenty of vocational and recreational activities as an integral part of their treatment. Psychotropic medications weren't available back then, obviously, so directing their focus to projects was a helpful way of keeping people deemed mentally ill distracted and mostly free from symptoms. Moral therapy turned out to be quite effective. One of the requisites, though, was that hospital populations remained low, so that patients could be given individual attention. As we now know, the booming rise of patients being sent to asylums did not allow for that to happen. And so moral therapy sort of faded into the woodwork. You may also recall from our series on Trenton Psychiatric Hospital that moral therapy wasn't used in the jails and poorhouses that typically housed people deemed mentally ill. Dr. Helmbold, the man who peddled elixirs and escaped multiple times from asylums in the US and France, said that these jails were the worst places he had ever seen. He described rotting floors and maybe some straw to sleep on. For anyone, let alone someone in psychiatric crisis, these are far from ideal conditions. They were overcrowded, poorly funded, under-resourced, and as Dr. Helmbold had implied, hygienically problematic. All that context is what brings us to New York State in the mid-1800s. Politicians were growing aware of the deplorable conditions of the jails and almshouses where the state's mentally ill currently resided. There were other asylums in New York at the time, namely the Bloomingdale Lunatic Asylum, which opened in 1821, and the State Lunatic Asylum in Utica, which opened in 1843. Bloomingdale was part of the New York Hospital in New York City, but it wasn't a state-run facility. The asylum in Utica was the first state-sponsored asylum. As we've discussed and alluded to in previous episodes, anyone with a physical, mental, or developmental disability was considered a shame on their family. I really hope there were exceptions to this, that there were more people who fell into that category who were loved and supported by their family members. But many were abandoned to asylums or poorhouses. Some would be expected to work without pay if they were able. Others were left alone, neglected, and starved. Dorothea Dix was visiting and investigating asylums and poorhouses all over the East Coast starting in the 1840s. This kick-started the conversation about the deplorable conditions of those facilities. By the 1850s, politicians were also investigating these places and coming to similar conclusions as Dix. The poorhouses were not sustainable places for insane folks to be held. The country was progressing, and they didn't want to be housing people in unsafe and unsanitary conditions. By the 1860s, politicians were looking for a way to relieve the overcrowding in poorhouses and provide more humane treatment for the people deemed insane. An investigation in 1864 determined that the current conditions of the jails and poorhouses were unfit for the insane. But they didn't want to spend a fortune on a new asylum either. So they looked for a way to build a new facility as inexpensively as possible. It would be a bare bones effort. They could provide just enough rations for patients to be healthy and taken care of, and they'd rely on patient labor to run most of the operations. It seemed like a win-win to them, probably. Patients would benefit from the therapeutic labor, and the hospital would save money on costs and potentially profit from their work. Of course, in retrospect, we know that this was patient exploitation, but at the time, it seemed like maybe the best course of action. According to an article by Atlas Obscura, quote, New York Surgeons General Dr. Sylvester D. Willard proposed a state-run hospital for the insane. Abraham Lincoln himself signed off on the proposal a mere 6 days before his death, end quote. When I first read that, I said, wow, out loud. I mean, what are the chances that Lincoln would approve this new facility only 6 days before he was killed? And not to split hairs too much, Atlas Obscura, but April 8th was actually 6 days before Lincoln was shot, but 7 days before he died. Ironically, Dr. Willard himself had also died just days before his proposal was signed into law on April 2nd, 1865. He was only 39 years old. This proposal came to be known as the Willard Act, as I mentioned, passed on April 8th, 1865, 6 days after Willard's death and a week before President Lincoln's assassination. In the proposal, Dr. Willard had described his visits to various facilities and the conditions he found in them. He mentioned that the asylum in Utica appeared to be a grand and successful hospital, but it was maxed out and simply could not house the number of people who needed to be there. At the time, patients were allowed to stay at the Utica Asylum for only a year before they were sent back to their home county. Obviously, for chronic cases of mental illness, this wasn't a very good option. So Dr. Willard had sent a series of 68 questions to each county in New York about the current conditions of their facilities for the insane. Among the questions were, how many insane are there at present provided for? How many males are capable of labor? How many females are capable of labor? What amusement have those who are unable to work? How many are restrained by chains or handcuffs occasionally? How often are the insane required to bathe? How many insane sleep in one bed? And this one gets me. Ugh. Did you look for vermin on their persons? Did you observe any vermin? What number of insane is your county house designed to accommodate? How many escaped within a year who are not returned? So Dr. Willard had gotten responses from all but four counties in New York, and the answers were dismal. It became clear that the counties could not afford to care for these folks or be able to treat them properly. So Dr. Willard, along with then New York Governor Fenton, came up with this proposal, which was passed. Quote, let an institution for incurables be established. Let the incurables be there colonized. Take the insane from the counties where they are ill provided for first, and change the law relative to the insane poor, so that counties shall not have the management of them, nor any authority over them. The statistics gathered showed that out of 1,345 insane, 345 are capable of labor. Properly managed, this number would be increased, and there would be gathered into such an institution scores of mild cases now at large, whose friends, unable to support them at the state asylum, are unwilling to consign them to the miseries of the poorhouse. By such a regulation, the cost of supporting each insane person would be diminished, so that the expense to each county would not be greater, and probably much less than it now is, while the lunatics would enjoy the benefits and comforts of a well-regulated institution. The early attention to their care would doubtless ensure recovery to a much larger number than now become restored, and cases that progress to violence, filth, or dementia might remain mild and passive, end quote. And so Willard's law was signed into law, and the construction of the Willard Asylum for the Chronic Insane was approved. I couldn't find how the location for the asylum was chosen, but it was built in the small town of Ovid, New York, right along Seneca Lake in the Finger Lakes region. The land already had one building called the Agricultural College, but it was immediately clear that it would not be able to house all of the people who'd come to reside at the new asylum. We would have to build a larger structure. I should mention here that I'm getting a lot of my information about the construction and history of Willard Asylum from a really great online source compiled by Seneca County historian Walter Gable in 2018. I'll provide a link to the source in the transcript. If you'd like more information, I encourage you to check it out. It was really helpful to me during my research. He also has quite a few photos that I'll try to use, but I won't certainly be able to use them all. So if you want to see more pictures, then check out that link. Construction of the new facility began in July 1866. It was built in the typical Kirkbride style with a mix of Victorian and Italianate influenced buildings on the campus overlooking Seneca Lake. Now I find these types of buildings absolutely stunning, and I'm not gonna lie, I wish we still had them around today. So 3 years later, construction had progressed so much by May 1869, although the building wasn't quite finished yet, the governor was able to establish a board of trustees and appoint Dr. John Chapin as medical superintendent. Although construction would still be ongoing, the new asylum sent out notices to counties saying they could start sending patients as soon as October 12th, 1869. I want to offer a trigger warning for this next section as we discuss the conditions the first patients arrived in. It's pretty horrific and includes evidence of abuse and medical neglect. The first patient to arrive at Willard Asylum was a woman named Mary Rote, who arrived on October 13, 1869 via steamboat. As the boat pulled up to the dock at Ovid Landing, the staff noticed that she was, quote, a feeble, demented woman brought in irons. She had been confined over 10 years and for most of the time had been in a nude state. She was found crouched in a corner of a cell, partially covered with blankets, but without any other clothing or even a bed, end quote. After she arrived at Willard, Mary was given a room with a bed, fresh clothing, and cleaned up. I can only imagine the dignity that was restored for her that day. I hope she felt so good. And Mary would end up staying at Willard until her death from tuberculosis 6 years later. Mary wasn't the only patient admitted that first day. Walter Gable points out that, quote, on the same day, three men were brought in irons. One of these men had been occasionally industrious. All, when excitable, had been confined for long periods in rooms called cells. One man, immediately on his removal from the state asylum to the county house, was placed in a cell with his hands and legs confined in irons and chains, receiving his food through a hole in the door. Quick interruption just to say that this is still common practice in many U.S. prisons. It's pretty standard. In this condition, he passed 3 years. One patient was brought to the asylum who had been an inmate of the county house 22 years, spending the greater portion of the time in a room 5 by 6 feet in size without a window. This person, from long disuse and debility, had quite lost the control of his limbs, end quote. So this is describing muscle atrophy, which is quite common for folks who are bedridden long term. Today, we also recognize other potential dangers for people who are bedridden, such as sores that can become septic, deep vein thrombosis or DVT, which can cause serious blood clots and pulmonary embolism. For patients today who are placed into 5-point restraints, for example, they are carefully monitored by nursing staff and offered a special compression device that helps prevent blood clots in their legs. Gable also mentions that, quote, the names of these insane persons were not stated in the previous reports that the Willard Asylum made to the state of New York. Their names, however, appear in the 1870 U.S. Census records. That's how we know that the first female patient's name was Mary Rote. The first three male patients were Alonzo Hopkins, Abram Lewis, and John S. Page, end quote. Other patients who were among the first admitted to Willard Asylum included a woman who was described as having, quote, a procedentia of the uterus when she was admitted. She was in a, quote, state of maniacal excitement and filthy in her habits. She had been in a state of nudity and had not received the attentions of a female attendant, end quote. I'm not a medical expert. I'm a psychologist. So I had to look up procedentia of the uterus. I'm sure there are already medical folks listening who are well aware of this affliction. It sounds awful. And if you're squeamish with gross medical stuff, you might want to skip forward just about 30 seconds. So I looked this up, and procedentia is essentially the most severe type of uterine prolapse, where the entire uterus is outside the vagina. And this had to be uncomfortable, maybe very painful for this woman. And the fact that she was going around nude and untreated must have left her vulnerable to all sorts of infections and God knows what else. I might get a little maniacal myself if I weren't getting the treatment I needed for that. Another patient, a man, was admitted to Willard after he had been, quote, secured to a post with a chain in a house adjacent to the county poorhouse, end quote. Usually in these poorhouses, the most violent were placed in dungy basements. So I wonder what the rationale was to chain a man to a post next door. Again, I can only imagine the relief that man must have felt when his chains were removed and he was cared for like a human being. Other patients were sent in similar conditions. Some arrived without clothing, others covered with vermin and dirt. 61 of the first patients admitted to Willard had come from the asylum in Utica, either diagnosed as incurable or they had reached the end of their year-long commitment. Willard Asylum was essentially designated to be the final destination, if you will, for the chronic and incurably insane. And not just anybody could be sent to Willard. This isn't the type of place where a husband would drop off his wife if she weren't doing the dishes to his liking. There was a process in place that's strikingly similar to current practices in the U.S. First, the patient had to be referred for admission by the county superintendent of the poor. The patient then needed two certificates of insanity provided by medical examiners. I was glad to see that the physicians had to have attended credible medical schools and their qualifications be certified by a judge. Remember that at this time, there were people like Dr. quote-unquote Helmbold who just made an elixir and called himself a doctor. The referral and the two certificates of insanity had to be reviewed and approved by a county judge who would finally determine if the patient should be committed to Willard. So it was and still remains a process. And yet we still have people who believe they can drop off problematic family members at a state hospital and call it good. At least in California, there's a very long wait list for patients to be accepted into our state hospitals, and all of them go through the judicial system in one form or another. As we mentioned with Mary Rote, most admissions arrived at Willard via steamboat. Their chains and irons were removed on the dock, and once admitted, they were bathed, examined, dressed, and fed. The tenets of moral therapy were implemented in the early days at Willard. They were treated with kindness and respect. If they were able, they were encouraged to work in the production shops or on the farm. By 1870, Willard Asylum housed 125 men and 450 women patients. By 1872, construction of the main building was finally complete, 6 years after it had started. According to Walter Gable, quote, the center building was 70 by 34 feet, three stories high on a basement just below ground level. The wings were the wards, south for women, north for men, and they were 171 feet long and 40 feet wide, with a hall 12 feet wide running down the center, end quote. And I'm thinking of the hospital where I work, and I would guess that our hallways are maybe 6 feet wide. Many patients like to pace up and down the halls, so it starts to feel cramped very quickly. 12-foot wide halls sounds like a luxury. So Gable continues, quote, the rooms were 9 by 11 feet. The east wing from the center was 311 feet long and contained the kitchen, boilers, laundry, and bakery, with the chapel above the kitchen. Limestone quarried on the asylum grounds was used for the foundation. The walls of the building were of brick that was made locally, end quote. The asylum was originally designed to accommodate 500 patients, which was a problem because, as I mentioned earlier, Willard already had 575 patients 2 years before construction was completed. Whoops. So already the asylum had outgrown its needs. And counties around New York still had hundreds of chronically mentally ill folks housed in poorhouses. Remember that the intent of the 1865 Willard Law was to move all of those people to Willard Asylum, but there was clearly a long way left to go. The patient population at Willard had soared to 1,550 patients by 1877, and Willard was the largest asylum in the U.S. There were plans already in place to expand the hospital, but administrators already knew it wouldn't be enough. The state needed another facility. So plans were made to construct a similar hospital in Binghamton, and Binghamton State Asylum opened in October 1881 in southern New York. To help alleviate the overcrowding at Willard Asylum, Superintendent Chapin was able to get funding to add 3 new wards to the south wing of the main building, to construct 5 new buildings, and make some infrastructure changes. The Agricultural College, which was the original building on the site, was renovated to accommodate 200 women of the, quote, quiet type, whatever that means. The upper floors were deemed a fire hazard, so the building was reconstructed. They actually removed the top 2 floors of the south part of the building and built an addition to the north side. The Agricultural College was initially renamed The Branch. So you'll notice that they were very clever with their names at the beginning. The main building was called The Main Building, and this secondary location 3/4 of a mile away was called The Branch. Very straightforward, very utilitarian. And again, super creative in their naming. The 5 new buildings were known as detached buildings, or DBs. The first detached building was known cleverly as DB1, and it opened in 1872. It was later renamed the Maples. I'd like to think that somebody said, DB1 is not a name for a building. They probably looked around at the property, at the trees, pointed to one and said, I don't know, call it the Maples or something. DB2 opened in 1876. It was renamed years later. And again, I imagine someone looking outside, pointing to a tree and saying, I don't know, maybe pine this time. And so it was renamed the Pines. By 1878, the remaining 3 detached buildings were completed. DB3 was renamed, surprisingly, not after trees this time. They must have had somebody else name that building. It became Sunnycroft for some inexplicable reason. Maybe it was named after a staff member, or who knows. DB4 was renamed Edgemere in 1904. The steward's house was renamed Bleak House, which is arguably a worse name than before. And in 1884, the men's infirmary opened and was later renamed Hermitage. And in 1887, the branch opened as the women's infirmary. Later, once they became a little more creative with building names, the women's infirmary was known as Grand View, referring to the grand view it had of Seneca Lake. By September 1885, the Willard Asylum was practically a city on its own. It sat on 929 acres of land. There was the main building with wings on either side to accommodate 600 patients each, the 5 detached buildings, multiple farm and utility buildings, a 30-acre cemetery, and even a hotel at the lake dock. It's no surprise, then, that visitors came to Willard to form their own opinions of the new facility, and the responses were largely positive. A reporter from New York World praised the facility for removing patients from their previous horrible living conditions and commended the patients for their fieldwork and embroidery and other crafts. A report of a visit from 100 medical and lay personnel noted the bucolic environment surrounding the asylum and the kindness of staff. And a, quote, November 1886 visit by Cayuga County supervisors learned that since 1869, there had been 3,738 admissions, of whom 133 had been discharged as recovered and 332 as improved, end quote. I'm a little confused on the math here. I don't think there were over 3,000 patients remaining at Willard in 1886, so I'm not sure what happened to the others not accounted for here. Now, as I mentioned at the start of this episode, part of what kept costs down at Willard was using patient labor to maintain the facility. While working does have therapeutic benefits for patients, it was the unpaid labor and exploitation of their services that bothers me. Patients were encouraged to work, but not forced. Gable says that, quote, in 1883, there were 801 patients willing and able to work. There were 261 who were able but wouldn't work in some cases because of delusions, but usually because of laziness or stubbornness, end quote. I don't like the use of the terms lazy and stubborn here because there may have been valid reasons for someone not wanting to work. Many mental illnesses can be both emotionally and physically exhausting. If someone has negative symptoms of schizophrenia, like flat affect, avolition, anhedonia, etc., they may not even care to get up and do anything. It's not a lack of willpower, it's a symptom of their illness. And sure, there were probably some who just didn't want to work, but if they weren't getting paid to work, what's the incentive? Patients could work various jobs around the asylum property, maintaining the grounds, working in the laundry, kitchen, or bakery, working in the carpentry shops, paint shops, shoe shops, butcher shops, tailor shops, working in the sewing room, or ward work. Almost half of all patients who came to Willard engaged in some form of working. These early work-driven therapeutic approaches appeared to be helpful in lowering violence rates too. Gable points out that in 1874, 5% of patients were restrained mechanically. By 1881, only 0.5% were restrained. Now, what fascinates me is that this is all before the advent of psychotropic medications. This is a large hospital of at least 1,500 patients. And these are the most chronically mentally ill folks in the state. And the restraint rates were very low. So something was clearly working and working well. Patients had a number of recreational activities they could enjoy too. Since the asylum was in a rather isolated location, they didn't have opportunities for outings like patients at other facilities may have had. Gable says, quote, the hospital's treatment plan included the belief that diversions, amusement, entertainment, and instruction was very important, end quote. And I tend to agree with this. The parts of treatment that are often patients' favorite aspects are these recreational activities because they inject color into an otherwise bland day. In 1883, the asylum added an amusement building that housed an auditorium on the first floor and rooms for male employees upstairs. The building was called the Lodge. Later, it served as the teaching space for the nurses' training school and even later, the Elizabeth Cady Stanton Children's Center. The asylum had put on concerts, theatrical productions, lectures, readings, and so on. Patient art was framed and hung on the walls. In 1885, there were three performances of a play called Down by the Sea, and the cast consisted of four patients and five officers. There were weekly dances or baseball games, picnics, outdoor band concerts, anything that would lift the spirits of the patients who resided there. In 1898, the asylum held Willard's Field Day, which was open to the public. 1,400 patients and 1,600 members of the public attended. There was a parade led by the Willard Band and Fire Department. floats representing various hospital industries with workers actually engaged in their trades. So shoemakers, carpenters, mechanics, kitchen workers who tossed cakes and cookies into the crowd, and even a male quartet. By 1915, the annual field day was an event. That year, 5,000 people attended. There were 18 sports events, more decorated booths, and patient-made arts and crafts. The event seemed to be an opportunity for the public to interact with patients, and for patients to interact with the public, and reduce the stigma of mental illness. Again, I return to the thought of how this must have felt for the patients who'd arrived there after having lived in the squalor of jails and poorhouses, after they'd been starved, beaten, or in chains. It must have felt like a whole new life. In 1890, the State Care Act was passed. Now, to this point, Willard had only taken chronic cases of mental illness from all over New York. The State Care Act made two major changes. First, it changed the name of Willard Asylum for the Chronically Ill to Willard State Hospital. Second, it established hospital districts so that asylums could only accept patients from approved counties. Now, this actually makes sense to me, since there were now several asylums around New York who could care for the chronically mentally ill. It makes sense that they would accept patients who were closest to them in geographic proximity. That way, it wasn't just Willard Asylum that was bearing the brunt of admissions from poorhouses around the state. The benefit to this was that by 1894, all of the people deemed chronically ill in poorhouses had been transferred to one of the state hospitals. Because the act had limited the location of where patients could be accepted, they started not only accepting chronic cases of mental illness, but acute cases as well. And this was a first for them. In 1890, new superintendent Dr. Peter M. Wise established at Willard the first infirmary for invalid patients in any mental institution in the U.S. And changes were definitely coming to Willard. Without the funding to build a new admission and hospital building for the acute cases, changes were made to the main building, which, by the way, had been renamed Chapin House in 1904 after the first superintendent. Where there had been a separate dining room in each ward of that building, one central dining room was built to serve all three wards. Women were put in charge of the dining rooms, even on the men's wing. New flooring and steel ceilings were added, as were some new furniture. Wards number 7 on both the north and south wings were made into sick wards. There was an operating room at the end of each of these wards. Wards number 4 on both wings became admission wards. Wards number 8 and 9 were for the most disturbed cases, with wards number 5 and 6 for the less disturbed. The most hopeful cases were in wards 2 and 3, with ward number 1 having the mildest patients. In 1904, they must have hired that person I joked about earlier, who I think helped change the names of the buildings. So by 1904, almost everything was renamed by that time. Now, some of these I've already mentioned, but some of them are new. So Gable says, quote, "The branch building was renamed Grandview. Medic House became Hillside. The infirmary was renamed the Hermitage. DB1 became the Maples. DB2 was renamed the Pines. DB3 became Sunnycroft. DB4 became Edgemere. The North Cottage was renamed Lake Farms. The South Cottage became Vinelands. The main building was renamed Chapin House. The superintendent's house became Brookside. The farmhouse was renamed The Grange. The steward's house became Bleak House, and the isolation hospital was renamed The Rookery," end quote. The turn of the 20th century would usher in even more changes for Willard State Hospital, but I'm going to save that for next time. And I apologize for this in advance, but I'm taking next week off to spend some time with friends and family, so I will have the next part of the history of Willard State Hospital for you in 2 weeks. And you will definitely want to come back to hear more. We'll talk about how Willard went from a place of healing to a less than therapeutic environment, shall we say. And you will want to know what they found after the hospital finally closed. So stay tuned for that. If you would like more content while I'm away, I encourage you to check out the podcast Hot Topics with Gabrielle Critchlow. I have 4 interviews on that show with her where I talk about schizophrenia and bipolar disorder and what it's like to work with people diagnosed with severe and persistent mental illness. Unrelated, I also have an episode on her show where I talk about the 2 years I spent in France as a study abroad student and a Fulbright recipient. So feel free to check out Hot Topics while I'm out. I put the links in the transcript at the very end of the transcript. So as always, thank you so much for listening. If you haven't done so already, please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening. That would really, really, really help me out. And feel free to share the show with someone who you think might enjoy it. And come back for more stories about Willard State Hospital. There's so much left to cover. This is a good one. And remember, do the best you can until you know better. And then when you know better, do better. Until next time. Thank you so much for listening to Behind the Walls of the World Psychiatric Hospitals. Once again, I'm your host, Dr. Sarah Gallup. Cover image is by Christopher Payne. Check out my website at behindthewallspodcast.buzzsprout.com. Follow the podcast and learn more on Facebook at Behind the Walls Podcast and Instagram at Behind the Walls Pod. For questions or recommendations, email me at behindthewallspodcast@gmail.com. You can find new episodes every Monday on Amazon Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening right now. If you like the show, please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. It helps other people find and listen to the show, and I would be so grateful. Please stay tuned for more episodes of Behind the Walls of the World Psychiatric Hospitals. Until next time.